Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How does our relationship to the built environment change when we seek out the opinions of knowledgeable critics? And what can we learn by engaging as citizen critics of the architecture that surrounds us? Scholars and writers from around the U.S. are gathering in North Texas this week for the inaugural David Dillon Symposium at the Dallas Museum of Art and the Nasher Sculpture Center. Participants will discuss changing venues and media for architecture criticism in the 21st century and the changing role of such criticism in public life. We're joined this hour by two guests who will play a part in that symposium. Alexandra Lang is an architecture and design critic who teaches at NYU and the School of Visual Arts. Her new book is called Writing About Architecture, Mastering the Language of Buildings and Cities. Kate Holliday is assistant professor in the School of Architecture at UT Arlington and director of the David Dillon Center for Texas Architecture. She's also author of the forthcoming book, Ralph Walker, Architect of the Century. Kate, Alexandra, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Kate, just to start us out, can you remind us of the remarkable legacy of David Dillon as a critic and as a professor?
Well, David Dillon was architecture critic for the Dallas Morning News for 25 years between 1981 and 2006. And I did not have the pleasure of knowing him personally, but in reading through the more than 1,000 articles that he wrote for the Dallas Morning News, it's been a great opportunity to really learn about the city and to get to know a critic who spent a great deal of time thinking critically and thinking passionately about the issues that shaped Dallas architecture and Dallas urbanism and what direction he really believed it should go. It's a tremendous legacy and one that has served the city very well.
Is it reasonable to say that the things that are being built now and the way that the city has embraced architecture is in part due to his influence?
I think it's fair to say that. David was a very clear voice in support of good modern design. He spent a great deal of time focused on neighborhood policies and trying to bring attention to economic development in areas of Dallas that haven't received as much economic development as other areas. He spent a great deal of time supporting bringing attention to Fair Park, and many of the issues that he was an activist critic about are some of the things that we still talk about, and he helped keep them in the limelight.
Alexandra Lang, you make your living writing about architecture as a professional, but you also say it's really important for regular people to engage as citizen critics. First of all, what does that term mean?
Well, for me, I sort of invented it for my book, I think. But for me, it means that everyone needs to think critically about where they live in the city that they live in. And I think that by learning from professional architecture critics, learning the language of criticism, learning what to look for from criticism, they can become better and more active citizens in terms of making their neighborhoods better places to live. I mean, in New York, we have community boards. Architects of new projects need to go before community boards. And I feel like too often people have reservations about projects, but they don't know how to express them, or they don't know how to use the same language as architects. And I feel like my book and just a general awareness of the field of architecture criticism can really help people to feel like they have a voice and they can improve projects that are planned for their area.
To what extent does jargon get in the way of people really understanding what's being written about architecture?
I think it's a huge problem. I don't think architects sometimes even realize that they're using jargon because they're used to talking about spaces rather than, you know, the specific area, or they talk about materials in terms of their ephemeral qualities rather than in terms of their color and their true nature. And I think it's really important for everyone to be on the same page in terms of language. And I know I, as a critic, try to be really detailed when I'm describing something. You know, why does this pathway not work? What's it made of? Like, how tall are the steps? Like, all of these specifics are are the things that make architecture a great place to be or not a great place to be? And so I think we all need to be on a more specific and concrete page together.
It occurred to me when I was preparing to do this show that in some ways, good architecture criticism is a little bit like good food writing. To the extent that you want this description that makes you feel as if you have been there, even if you have no plans to immediately visit a space or in, you know, the case of a food critic, a restaurant.
Yeah, I think that's completely true because, in fact, you know, one of the forefathers of architecture criticism, Lewis Mumford, wrote for The New Yorker, and there were never photographs with his reviews because The New Yorker didn't publish photographs till, I think, about 15 years ago. And you can read his reviews, and those buildings come up in your mind. And he was incredibly careful. Most of his reviews are organized as a walkthrough, so you really go from the sidewalk outside into the building and up through the building. And I think that can be a bit of a lost art because now every article has a slideshow of photographs, but you never know what the photo editor is going to think is important. And I think as a critic, you need to kind of ward off some, you know, random photo of a detail by describing what you think is important in your review.
Well, let's talk more about that because you guys are both quite young, but even the amount of years between undergraduate students that you might work with and yourselves, a lot has changed in terms of, you know, we have a lot of publications that are providing dedicated issues for their online audience so that they can view something with an iPad or they can look at video. I mean, to what extent do we need to avoid getting hung up on the technology? And to what extent do we need to avoid sort of shying away from it when it might enhance good writing?
Well, one thing I talk about a lot with my students is that it's really the content of what they want to say rather than where they say it in a lot of ways that they need to focus on first. Because you can write and have opinions about architecture all you want, but unless you're saying it in a compelling way and in a way people can understand, you can put it on a blog, you can put it in a magazine, you can put it in a book, and it's not going to have the same kind of impact if you've thought about it and you know why you want to say what you're saying. It'll find an audience.
And I think, I mean, all different types of media are also interpretive. I mean, you can write a long critique, you can critique something on Twitter or on Tumblr, or if you're a skilled photographer, you can also critique through photography. I personally have always been a word person and I'm a terrible photographer, so I would never go in that direction. But I always encourage my students when we do field trips to take notes however they feel most comfortable, and a lot of them are snapping away with their iPhones. Some people have sketchbooks. Some people write down kind of a narrative of the experience, and all of those are equally valid ways of taking visual notes, and then I think those feed into the way that the students will eventually produce some criticism.
So assuming that everybody listening today might want to be a citizen critic, even if for themselves and no one else, talk about the best ways to engage with a built space to fully understand even what it means to you as an individual.
One thing I really like to encourage students to do is actually go sit and just watch for a long time, not 5 minutes, but actually be still and watch what other people are doing in that space. Try to figure out, is everyone confused? Can you tell that people don't know where to go? Are they enjoying themselves? And really watch over a long period of time. It's a really good way to try to get out of just your own experience and try to figure out what other people are thinking as well.
I think it's also really important just to walk around. You know, pick a place that you've always moved through quickly and spend time, you know, going up the ramp, taking every staircase, figuring out where people are and where people aren't. I mean, there's this amazing and still relevant book, The Social Life of Small Urban Spaces by William White, in which he trained cameras on all these small plazas in New York City and did essentially what we're saying to do. He watched, he walked, he sat, but with a camera, and so over a long duration. And he got data about what worked and what didn't from these films. And I think you can gather some part of that data yourself just by spending time to look carefully and watch carefully.
Yeah, there are so many beautiful buildings today that are just stunning visually that may work beautifully on the inside and function really well, or they may be sort of a disaster, you know, so that functionality is sacrificed for what they look like on the outside.
Well, I think that is one thing, that translating a building from the drawing board or a computer into an actual three-dimensional volume that people really walk through is really hard. And I think that's one thing that students learn as they're learning how to build, is that what you have in your head may not be the same thing once you actually build it. And I think that's one reason why design students should really spend time looking and thinking about the way people use things in the real world, to try to anticipate some of the way those things shift when they actually become real.
My guests this hour are Kate Holliday, who is assistant professor in the School of Architecture at UT Arlington and director of the David Dillon Center for Texas Architecture. Alexandra Lang is here as well. She's an architecture and design critic who teaches at NYU and the School of Visual Arts. Both are participating in the inaugural David Dillon Symposium today and tomorrow at the Dallas Museum of Art and the Nasher Sculpture Center. We'll come back to this conversation in a moment, and we welcome you to join us on the phones at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. We are joined now by a third important guest in the studio, Jeff Whittington, who is a senior producer of Think, host of Anything You Ever Wanted to Know. Hello, Jeff.
Hi, Chris. What a fascinating discussion. And, of course, we always love to talk about design and trends and architecture. And I think it's really interesting today that we're talking about criticism and sort of figuring out what works and what doesn't work. Well, this station only works if you participate as more than just a listener. And that's what we're doing today. It's the second day of the membership campaign, and we're inviting you. Please call 888-694-6931 or contribute online at kera.org.
Think about it this way. You have contracted with, hired KERA as your personal source of news and information and entertainment. We are here fulfilling our end of the bargain by serving you 24 hours a day, 7 days a week of great content from North Texas and also from around the country and indeed around the world. NPR has journalists stationed permanently in a lot of places where other news organizations have had to cut staff. All of that comes with a cost, and your contribution at 1-888-694-6931 or online at kera.org makes it possible for us to serve you.
Yeah, and we're not asking you to make the investment and then figure out if it works or not once it's built, because it's already built.
You figured it out, right, exactly.
Yeah, you're already using it. It's already working for you. We're working for you. The station is working for you. We're just asking you to contribute what you think it's worth to you. And if you think that $120 contribution is the right level, well, we can thank you with a copy of one of our guests' book, Alexandra's book, Writing About Architecture, Mastering the Language of Buildings and Cities. We'd be happy to send you a copy of that. Of course, it's available. The book is out there. It's available right now. But we would be thrilled to thank you with your very own copy when you join the station today with a contribution of at least $120 or become a sustaining member for $10 a month. You can set it up as a bank draft, or you can use a credit or debit card to pay your $10 a month to the station, and we'll thank you with your very own copy. To do it, call 888-694-6931 or click and join online at kera.org.
I think this happens to you as well, Jeff, but when I go to a station event, I often have the pleasure of talking to people who listen to the show, who really love to engage with it, and they'll say, the only problem is I'm spending so much money, buying all the books I hear discussed and, going to the films and checking out the things. If you're spending money to educate yourself with these materials, which we know many of you are, this is a station for lifelong learners, it also makes sense to invest a little bit of your personal education budget in this station that, in fact, you turn to every single day for this show and for all the other programs that we have to offer.
Yeah, I talked to many of you out in the community at arts and citywide events and things, and you always say, oh, I'm always listening to Think, in the middle of the day. I'm out running errands. I'm at lunch. It's something I'm listening at my desk. And if you find yourself tuning in and listening to these conversations that Chris has with our various and variety of guests, then you listen. You listen more than you probably listen more than you think. So we would love to have you as more than just a listener. Be someone who takes responsibility for the fact this station relies on your contribution to function and to stay healthy. And make the call, 888-694-6931. Or click and join at kera.org.
We try to make it really easy for you. There are a variety of ways to pay. You can do this with a credit or debit card. You can send in an old-fashioned check, if that's still how you like to do things. Or, of course, you can sign up for the sustaining membership, which is a monthly draw from your account into the KERA membership account. However you want to do it, please get in touch now at 1-888-694-6931 or online at kera.org. Thanks.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Kate Holliday, who is assistant professor in the School of Architecture at UT Arlington and director of the David Dillon Center for Texas Architecture, and Alexandra Lang, architecture and design critic who teaches at NYU and the School of Visual Arts. Both are participating in the inaugural David Dillon Symposium today and tomorrow at the Dallas Museum of Art and the Nasher Sculpture Center. If you would like to join this conversation, give us a call at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So we've talked about the importance of seeing how well a space really works. How important is it for people who want to understand architecture to know the politics, the red tape, the sort of code and zoning issues that also go into creating a building?
I actually think people could really learn a lot by understanding the way that architecture gets made, because it can be a very long process. And especially the effects of zoning regulations, the way that city codes work, and that's the part of the actual mechanics of how things get built. There could really be a wonderful thing to really demystify that process and make it something that people participate in and understand in a much more clear way.
Right. I mean, I think the first step is understanding the built environment, and then the next step is understanding how it came to be that way, because part of the solution for a built environment that isn't working is understanding how it came to be, and so perhaps how it could be undone or improved, or what kind of mechanisms you need to make it better. And I think that one of the great things about having a local critic that's writing all the time for a newspaper is that they have time to start explaining those things mm-hmm. to their readers. They're not flying by the city. They develop a relationship, and you can take a column and explain, you know, what zoning is at work, in this current controversy, and how it might operate to change the building. And that's part of having somebody who is interested in the city long term and is talking to people long term.
And thinking about one of David's articles in particular that I really admire, it was, "Where are they all going to live?" It was an article about affordable housing. Mm-hmm. And it took a huge amount of effort on his part and other newspaper staffers' part to do the research, to really think about where economic development was headed, why things were being built where they were, and how policies could be developed that might encourage other kinds of developments to take place.
Well, that approach seems so much more organic than going, you know, to the great capitals of the world and looking only at the buildings by, you know, big architects. Because I suppose if you don't have a sense of how something works within a community, it really, you lose all context for the criticism, right?
Yes, you do. I mean, I think it's important to see the work of the great architects also. And in fact, seeing their work elsewhere can inform your knowledge about and critique of what they're doing for your city. I mean, I saw the Kimball Museum for the first time yesterday, and I went to college at Yale, so I'd seen two other of Louis Kahn's buildings. And it's so interesting to see what the similarities of those buildings, but also the differences, partially due to the climate, to the space, to, you know, what the client required. So I don't think that's completely beside the point. But on the other hand, it kind of goes back to walking around. Like, when you go and see a building, do you just walk in the front door, or do you walk around the block and see the backside? Do you try to understand what kind of a district it's in? The cultural district in Fort Worth, where I was yesterday, is a good example of how, if you just looked at the buildings individually, they wouldn't make as much sense, and it's really not as interesting than looking at them as an ensemble.
Mm-hmm. What does it take to give students the confidence to criticize buildings or architects or designers who are almost sacrosanct, who have been dubbed the geniuses of their generation?
We were just talking about this in class this week. If my students are listening, they're probably laughing. But I had one student who was writing about Ian Pei and Fountain Place, Dan Kiley's landscape design at the base. And it's such a revered landmark here in the city that it was interesting to think about whether or not the student's opinion was simply something that she had heard, mm-hmm. or if it was something that she had really started to work through on her own. And I think that's part of what I really like about Alexandra's writing and her book, is that it really encourages people to look hard at their own thoughts and think about why they think what they do, and try to move a little bit further than maybe I've heard it was good, mm-hmm. but to think about why.
Yeah, that is always a challenge in my classes, especially at NYU where I teach undergraduates, because I feel like the way writing is taught, it tends to leach opinion out of it, because students are spending so much time focusing on the structure of their argument, do they have the appropriate footnotes, etc. And all of that is great, and you should know that too. But then they get to my class, and I'm saying, no, you have to be an authority. Like, the only way to write criticism is from a place of authority. So you have to figure out what you think you know about. What's your particular insight about this place? And that your opinion matters. If you don't think it's working, it's not working. And let's figure out how you can say that so you can convince other people that it's not working also.
Is it important to be deliberately provocative?
Oh, that's a great question.
I don't think so. I think it's important a lot of times these days to be deliberately provocative in your headlines or in whatever link goes out on Twitter. But in your writing, no. I do think that slow and steady wins the race, that a well-constructed argument doesn't have to be shouty. It just has to describe and describe in a way that the point you're getting across is clear, that this is not working, and you can do that very in a very low-key manner. And it's like when people get to the end of your review, they suddenly realize, oh, I didn't think that before, mm-hmm. and now I do.
Do you have any sense of that?
I think that provocative writing often really draws people in because it makes them want to take a side. And I'm not sure that that actually should necessarily be the result of a review. I'm thinking of a building that I really love and a lot of people don't, which is Charles Morris Piazza d'Italia in New Orleans. Mm-hmm. It's a very controversial project, which opened when I was a child, and I have a huge love for that project. And there's been a lot of writing about it that really says it's a terrible design. And I feel like coming up with that kind of black and white distinction can often really distract from a more nuanced, deeper understanding of a place or of a building.
What's the value of a re-review for a building that has existed? And I'm thinking, I guess the most famous example is, you know, the pyramid at the Louvre. And when it was first built, people were like, oh my God, how could you ruin the Louvre? And now Parisians in particular are so proud of this and they love it.
Well, that's a great example because it's a great example because the anticipation of what that design would do was, again, based on drawings, mm-hmm. not really based on being there or figuring out what it did. And after people have gotten a chance to actually experience what that space is like and what it does, it has a kind of functionality that maybe this strange glass pyramid in a model didn't necessarily suggest in its initial showing.
It's so funny. That question comes up so often. It feels like the public, or at least some aspect of the public, is dying for re-reviews, and those are so hard to get an editor to agree to let you do.
Really?
Because, yeah, there's this real news orientation, obviously, in newspapers and magazines. And so once something's been open, even for 3 or 4 months, it can feel sort of over. And I think actually that problem is exacerbated by the distribution of so many renderings that today look so much like photographs that I've often thought a building had already been built before it was built. Mm-hmm. And so by the time it was actually built, it felt like everyone had said everything they had to say. And that is problematic since that is not the point of the building. And I think seeing something a year later, 10 years later, you really get to see how it functions for the users, what's not holding up, all of that. And then, you know, at more of a 10-year span, you start to realize how taste has changed to either accept that in the case of the Louvre Pyramid or not accept it in the case of, I would say, there are a lot of postmodern buildings that started to look old right away.
I'm curious, Alexander, if you get pitched by PR firms for these architects and firms. I mean, we get pitches here, but I don't have an opinion on the show. So it's up to the guests, and how they do is really up to them. But I wonder if people think they know that you're going to love something. How does that work?
I do get pitches. I have to say I mostly ignore them all. at the moment, I'm in the position I write a weekly blog piece for the blog Design Observer, and then I do other freelancing. So I'm mostly picking my own topics. And so I kind of just wait to see what bubbles up that catches my interest. And I have a pretty broad array of interests in the world of architecture and design. So I try to just do what I like. I think if I did have a full-time job working for a newspaper, there would be more imperatives or things that it felt like this newspaper has to cover. But since that's not my situation, I kind of do what comes naturally.
My guests this hour are Alexandra Lang, who is an architecture and design critic and teaches at NYU and the School of Visual Arts. Kate Holliday is with us as well. She's assistant professor in the School of Architecture at UT Austin and director of the David Dillon Center for Texas Architecture. The inaugural David Dillon Symposium is taking place today and tomorrow at the Dallas Museum of Art and the Nasher Sculpture Center. If you want to be part of the conversation, give us a call. The telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Remember, a really important number to call today or this week or right now is 1-888-694-6931. You can also go online to kera.org. And Jeff Whittington, these are the ways that everyone who loves the show, who loves the station, can participate in a really important way.
Yeah, you can call 888-694-6931. Click and join at kera.org. As Chris and I have said many times, if everyone who's going to give during this drive would give today,
we'd be done.
We'd be done because we wrap up the drive when we reach the overall goal. And once we reach the overall goal, we wrap up the drive. So if we reached the goal today, meaning we got all the, you follow what I'm saying?
Wouldn't you love to just test them?
We
planned 9 days.
Yeah, we planned 9 days because last spring it took 18 days to make the goal. And that's a long time. That's really a long time. 9 days is much more manageable. That's our goal for this drive is to do it in 9 days to wrap up next Friday. So won't you please make your contribution right now instead of waiting until next Thursday or next Friday. Call 888-694-6931. Or click and join at kera.org.
The financial goals are still the same. We have to raise the money it takes to put this programming on the air, to buy all the programs that come to us from national and international sources, to pay the staff salaries, to have award-winning local news coverage, to have a show like this one on the air, locally produced for North Texas. We're just trying to do it faster. So if you can take action today, right now, you won't have to think about it anymore, and you won't somehow, when we ask for money, you'll think, I am done. I'm in the clear. And in fact, instead of each pledge break making you feel a little guilty and a little weird, it'll make you feel great. So give that a try at 1-888-694-6931 or go online to kera.org where you can check out thank you gifts, including a copy of Alexandra Lang's book.
Yes, it's called Writing About Architecture, Mastering the Language of Buildings and Cities. It covers a lot of the topics that we're covering on the show today. And it's very interesting and very actually very well reviewed. And we'd love to thank you with a copy of it with our thanks when you call 888-694-6931 or contribute at least $120 online at kera.org. Again, it's a thank you gift. You can go out and get your very own copy of the book, but we would be thrilled to provide one to you in exchange for your contribution. And thanks for your contribution. And really, the average gift of a KERA listener who becomes a contributor, Chris, it's about $10 a month or about $120 a year. So this is right in the wheelhouse of what most of your fellow listeners are giving to the station. And we'd love to hear from you right now.
There are some of you out there, of course, who are in a position to be a member at the Friends level, and that's $1,500 or more. We have friends, lots of friends, right at $1,500 a year. We have some who give us, you know, $5,000 and $10,000 and more $1,000 per year. But if you are in a position to do this for the station, if you value public radio, not just in your own life, but as a resource for your community, for civil discourse, for intelligent discussion of subjects that really matter, for almost no celebrity news, then your contribution right now would make a big difference to us. You can do this online at kera.org, or you can call 1-888-694-6931.
Yeah, the Friends level does provide, the Friends group of KER does provide a lot of support at the station. And, you know, we give back to that group. We had an event, Chris, you were there on stage, as a matter of fact, with Diane Rehm on Tuesday
Fantastic
night.
Fantastic to meet Diane
In front
Rehm.
Of about 300 friends and some of their guests. And we, you know, we're able to provide that kind of interaction with sort of one of the stars of public radio to our friends. So when you join the Friends group, you get invited to things like that when people come through. And we'd love to see your friends' contribution come across. It'd make a huge difference right now if you can give $1,500 or more. But it'd make a huge difference if you give whatever you can afford or want to afford to give. Just call 888-694-6931 or click and join at kera.org.
I think some of you, maybe we haven't done a great job communicating this, but the idea is that everyone who listens to the station regularly makes a contribution in some amount. For some of you, it'll be a couple dollars a month. For some of you, it may be a great deal more. A lot of you are sort of right in the middle. But we really, truly hope and expect that everyone who listens to the station will make a contribution. Jeff and I are members of the station. I think everybody on staff is. And I will tell you, there's no pressure. We do it because we believe in the product. So we earn a salary from KERA and we turn around. And because we all are very dedicated listeners, we are members of the station as well.
888-694-6931, online at kera.org. A couple of other thank you gifts that we have to offer. Of course, there's the Think mug, the black ceramic Think mug with the Think logo on it. And a lot of you, I know, have enjoyed having that, especially in meetings. You can kind of
hold it up to people
across the table. That's available at the $60 membership level, just $5 a month as a sustaining member. And we've heard from a couple of people here in the last few minutes. Chris.
Thank you so much, Kelly Henderson in Granbury, Fatina Wad in Irving. Thank you, Pornshree Chang in McKinney. And thanks to you, if you are on the phone right now at 1-888-694-6931 or you're online at kera.org, consider setting up a sustaining membership. Once you do it, you can, of course, change the amount at any time you want. If you need to even stop it, you can. But honestly, for most people who sign up, you sign it up and you leave it, and you know that your membership to the station is always current, that you are always making a contribution to this resource that gives so much to your life.
Yeah, it's a really efficient way for you to make your contribution to the station, and it really does help the station out quite a bit. So ask about the sustaining membership at 888-694-6931. And you can do it online as well. You can become a sustaining member at kera.org.
And remember, if you are already a sustaining member, maybe you were at $5 a month, maybe you're ready to do 10 or 15 or 20, you can also make an amendment to your Friends membership and increase that. Again, the number 1-888-694-6931. Thanks.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a graduate education flexible enough to allow you to explore what matters most to you. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guests this hour are architecture and design critic Alexandra Lang, who teaches at NYU and the School of Visual Arts. Kate Holliday is with us as well. She's assistant professor in the School of Architecture at UT Arlington and director of the David Dillon Center for Texas Architecture. The inaugural David Dillon Symposium is taking place today and tomorrow at the DMA and also at the Nasher Sculpture Center. If you want to be part of the conversation, call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So I'm really curious about this. Should your writing fundamentally change depending on whether you imagine the audience is a group of professionals as compared with a group of regular individuals?
My writing definitely does. You always have to consider audience, and I know Alexandra can address this as well. But you have to use different language. You have to really consider what you feel like people already know and why they want to read the piece in the first place. Mm-hmm. So when I write for architects, I know they want to read about things that may have an impact on the way they actually design, whereas the general public may want to read something that will encourage them to visit someplace new.
Mm-hmm. Most of my writing at this point is for the general public, and so I feel that I have incorporated some of the techniques you need to get people interested in terms of, you know, descriptive, maybe humorous lead-ins, all of this, making sure people know that this is not some sort of lesson. But when I do, give a talk for a more academic audience or write for architects, I think that there's more that can be left unsaid, and you also maybe need to go one level deeper into things like structure and how something's put together, and you know why the span is this number of feet rather than a different number of feet, because architects are really interested in that, and I know from feedback I get that sometimes they're very frustrated with the way architecture is covered for the general public because it's not mentioning any of these parameters that they have to deal with.
It's not enough.
Yeah. Right, right. But it's never enough. I mean, you could go on forever about a single building. There are whole books written about a single building, and generally I have about 1,200 words.
Well, you know, you said that you don't want it to be come across as a lesson when you write for the general public, and clearly you don't want to write in a way that is pedantic, and yet one of the functions of architecture criticism in general interest publications is education, right?
Well, I actually really love the writing of a very early architecture critic in America, Montgomery Schuyler. He wrote in the 1880s and the 1890s, and he had the really wonderful set of whiskers as well.
Everybody in that period, when you see photographs, yes. They're just astonishing.
I can just imagine conversations with him because he had a really wonderful way with words. And you knew he loved the Brooklyn Bridge, and he did not like the New York Tribune building. And he did not mince words, and there is something really terrific about the way he talked about writing, which architects liked and the general public liked as well. He's just a terrific writer.
I think I also teach Montgomery Schuyler in my class. And I think what's great about him is the directness, even though some of his language is somewhat archaic, he's still being quite direct. But also it's somewhat discursive. I mean, the piece that I assign is called The Evolution of the Skyscraper. And he's really talking you through how the skyscraper came to be, how the steel frame was developed, how the elevator came into play. And it's kind of like the inner workings of how the skyscraper happened. And I think that kind of discursive, I don't know, it's almost like walk along with me, drive along with me, that approach, you can really get a lot of information in, and people feel like the writer is discovering the information along with the reader. Charles Moore, who I also write about in my book, takes that approach as well. And you never feel like he's trying to, you know, get on top and teach you a lesson.
What is the market like these days for architecture criticism? It seems like, you know, when publications get squeezed, it's almost like the public schools. They cut out the arts and they cut out anything that some people might call extra. And people who are passionate about arts and design don't feel this is extra at all.
I think that's one of the things we'll talk about at the symposium is where is architecture criticism today? The traditional place that people looked for it for a long time was the daily newspaper in their city. And in many places, including here in Dallas, we no longer have a dedicated architecture critic with the loss of David Dillon. And it's not that it's not covered, but it's now divided up mm-hmm. amongst people who cover other arts as well. And part of the discussion will be, well, what do you lose when that happens? Many daily newspapers no longer have architecture coverage, or the fine arts person will cover a building every now and then. And it really changes the dynamic. Where do you look for local architecture writing especially? Because there's a lot of writing in books, there's a lot of architecture writing, but local architecture writing seems to really suffer.
Yeah, I think that's really true. I was involved in a Twitter discussion a few weeks ago, and I think we came up with the number of 11.5 as the number of newspaper architecture critics in North America these days.
Wow.
And the 0.5 was Philip Kennicott of the Washington Post, who also covers art, just because people always ask that. so that is a small number. I mean, it's even small, you know, given the number of large cities with healthy economies building things these days. And so It definitely feels somewhat embattled at that level. I mean, of course, there are also hundreds of new blogs and other outlets for architecture. But I do think that for a critic, having institutional support of some stature makes a difference. And I also think good architecture criticism takes time and money, and most blogs don't have the money to pay people to really go and look at things, and that's difficult.
Well, and it seems like what you lose when you don't have dedicated critics is the ability to cover not just the gigantic projects, but the smaller things that might highlight people who are not yet household words. There's only so much time to get to the sort of famous architects, and then there may be a lot of work that matters that we're not noticing.
And I think especially, again, at that local level, that's really a big issue. And I'm thinking, again, of one of David's pieces that I really liked, where he went and looked at all of the new park shelters around Dallas, which, again, that's not a very splashy kind of thing to do.
No, but I take my kids there all the time. It matters.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And it was pointing out how great they were, where they all are, because if it's not your neighborhood park, you might not know. But again, it gives you a chance to go visit someplace new, experience a new place, and it calls attention to the local architects who designed all of those shelters in a way that without that local publication, you just don't get that kind of attention.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. If you would like to join the conversation, you can also send email to think@kera.org. Okay, so Alexander, you mentioned that you are still very centered on the written word and that you're not a photographer per se. But I wonder if you think when it's well done by someone else, if there are certain technologies that can enhance the kind of work that you and other critics do.
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, Slate, the online magazine, often does architecture criticism as a slideshow, and they've developed that as a way, and it has commentary along with a series of images, not just of one building, and so there's actually a narrative to it, and that can be very effective. And I think all of these things can enhance each other. I mean, you, me, somebody writes their review and they describe a place, and then there's also a video of the people using the place or photographs of the details that they didn't have time to get to, and all of that together can paint a more complete picture. And given the fact that most publications now also have an online presence, you can have all of that online as an adjunct, and if people want to look deeper, they have the opportunity to look deeper.
And I can just add one of the things that, as a historian, my perspective is a little bit different. And some of the things that I've been working on with my students are things like digital reconstructions of neighborhoods in Dallas and Fort Worth that are lost. So there's something on top of them. No one really remembers what they are. And in those digital reconstructions, you have the ability to try to think about that urban process. Mm-hmm. How did we get to where we are? Which can be a really good supplement to thinking about, okay, I'm visiting the water gardens. What was here before?
Yeah. We actually have a discussion coming up next week with Mark Doty, who's got this great new book called Lost Dallas. And I'll tell him it's so sad to read about it, but it's one of the most fascinating things I've seen in a long time.
Yeah.
Oh, well, thank you both so much. It's been wonderful to have this discussion. I really appreciate the time that you've taken.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
My guests this hour have been Alexandra Lang, who is architecture and design architecture and design critic and teaches at NYU and the School of Visual Arts. Her new book is called Writing About Architecture, Mastering the Language of Buildings and Cities. Kate Holliday is assistant professor in the School of Architecture at UT Arlington, director of the David Dillon Center for Texas Architecture, and author of the forthcoming book, Ralph Walker, Architect of the Century. Both will take part in the inaugural David Dillon Symposium today and tomorrow at the DMA and also at the Nasher Sculpture Center. I want to thank all of you who are listening this hour. We really appreciate it. We especially appreciate your contributions to the station at 1-888-694-6931 and online at kera.org. That may be the fastest way that you can join. It does save us just a little bit in terms of processing costs, but however you want to do it, we appreciate your contribution and we would love to hear from you at this moment. We really feel it's important to have a resource like public radio in a community. We are expanding our award-winning local news coverage based on things that you've told us you want to hear, things that you want to understand. We're able to provide you these services to enhance our services to you, and quite frankly, just to continue what we've been doing, only because of contributions from listeners. You can make yours now, perhaps for the first time ever, online at kera.org or over the phone at 1-888-694-6931. 888-694-6931. Jeff Whittington is back in studio now. He is senior producer of Think and host of Anything You Ever Wanted to Know. Hey, Jeff.
Hi, Chris. And hello to you. Thanks so much for being with us today and every day during the midday show Think. We're really thrilled that you choose to listen to the station and you choose to interact on this show and email and call and participate. We're hoping that you'll do a little more than just be a listener. And, you know, it's great that we have you and about 320 some odd thousand other people listening each week right now as of our last ratings number. But we actually do require your contributions to keep the station healthy, to keep the station moving forward. And that's why we do these membership campaigns. It's the second day of the membership drive, the spring membership drive. You know, summer's coming, and it's going to be a long, hot Texas summer before we come back on the air and ask you to support the station again. This is how we do it a couple of times a year. We give you the phone number, we give you the web address, and we trust that you're going to do your part. The number to call is 888-694-6931. The place online, of course, it's kera.org.
You may have noticed, surely you've noticed, that KERA and NPR are really different from the other forms of talk radio available these days. And there's a reason for that that you may not have recognized. The reason that we can have civil discussions and respect different kinds of opinions and explore topics that are a little bit weightier than what you might hear elsewhere is because we don't have to generate a lot of controversy, a lot of spark, so that we earn money from advertisers who simply want a large number of ears there. We're able to respect your intelligence, your interests, and cover things in depth because a lot of our funding comes from people just like you. You can make your contribution now at kera.org online or over the phone at 1-888-694-6931.
I want to thank William Helmuth in Decatur, Ashley Barras in Fort Worth, and Darren Smith in Fairview. They have joined the station here in just the last few minutes. Thank you so much to each of you, William, Ashley, and Darren.
Thank you so much, Ella Coos in Irving and Lancer Hardy in Denton, also Barry Simpson in Midland. We really, really appreciate your support.
888-694-6931 is the phone number to call. Go online to kera.org. Check out one of our guests in this past hour, Alexandra Lang, has a book out called Writing About Architecture, Mastering the Language of Buildings and Cities. It's been out for about a month or so. It's been pretty well reviewed, and it's actually quite readable and gives you kind of like exercises and things to do.
It's great. It's very accessible. It is not dumbed down, but it's very accessible even if you don't have a substantial background in design and architecture, which I do not, but I found it really fascinating.
Yeah, it's like one of the exercises, find a fortified public space, watch how people interact and use the space, record your thoughts. It's really interesting way to think about the world that we live in. We kind of tend to sort of, oh yeah, a building. We built so many buildings in the last century or so. We were talking about this just the other day with Michael Potts from Rocky Mountain Institute. You know, thinking about buildings is something that's relatively new because for the last couple of hundred years, we just needed buildings. And now we're in a place where we can really start talking about how they work and how we use them.
And why they work. That's the best part.
Well, and that's what this membership campaign is about, too. It's our chance to tell you our story. It's our chance to tell you the public radio in North Texas story. You know, you already use the station, and you know how you use it. And I bet chances are that you listen quite a bit. Because once you found KERA, and we're thrilled to have you, but once you found it, you found a place that was different from everything else you hear on the radio. Now we're explaining to you how it works. And, you know, what we have been led to understand from what people like you, people who give to the stations, have told us is that most of you listen for about 5 years before you finally make a contribution. And by then, you understand the funding model. We are counting on you to make a contribution to keep this station strong. And please do it sooner than later, because we want to wrap this drive up so we can go back to making radio that you want to tune into every single day. Please do your part right now. Don't wait any longer. This is how it works. It all depends on you. The number to call is 888-694-6931, or click and join. Please do it today. Please do it right now at kera.org.
So many of you, this is always interesting to me, sort of define yourself as a public radio listener. It's a big part of your identity. It's a big part of the information that you consume in an average day or week or month, and yet have not yet made a contribution. And I have to wonder, like, what you're scared of, because it can't be the money, because you get to decide how much you want to contribute to the station. And it certainly can't be that you don't know if you're going to still stick with us, because you've been with us all along and you've been able to hear the kind of coverage, the kind of content that we bring to you, the tone in which it's presented. Public radio is for you, but it's also by you. You become a member of the team when you go to KERA.org or you call 1-888-694-6931.
This is your source for NPR News, 90.1 KERA, Dallas-Fort Worth Denton, also 100.1 K261 CW in Tyler, 88.3 K202 DR in Wichita Falls, and 99.3 K257 EV and Sherman. We also stream online at kera.org. And this show is a podcast, absolutely free for you to listen to online or download whenever you want. And if you're a podcast listener, we'd be thrilled to hear from you at 888-694-6931 or click and join. As we said before, it's always available, always safe and secure, always quick and convenient. You don't even have to talk to anybody. You can fill out the membership form yourself at kera.org.
And if you feel like you're a member of the Think team in particular, maybe you want to choose as your thank you gift a Think coffee mug. I'm really proud of the way these turned out. They look great. They're black and they have the Think logo, and they're not cheesy in the way that sometimes these things can be. They're nice looking.
When we run out of them, we're
well designed.
When we run out of these, we're going to get the Chris Boyd caricature mug. So. With the bobblehead lid.
Don't hold your breath. 1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number, or you can go to kera.org.
I'm working on it, folks. Seriously, I'm working on it.
I don't know. I'm not sure that we're going to have those. I'm not sure anyone except my mom and dad would buy them. And they only have so much cabinet space.
I'm kidding. They've already got 40 Think mugs. So, hey, get your own Think mug with a $60 contribution at 888-694-6931.
Thanks.